Welcome to another episode of Policy Talks. Today we have Mr. Sanjeev Sanyal with us. Mr. Sanyal is a member of the Prime Minister's Economic Council. He is also a secretary to the Government of India. He has been with the government for now more than 5 years. And he is here to, his past of course everybody knows as an economist, but today he is here to talk to us about more than economics. Welcome to the show, Sanjeev.
It's a pleasure indeed.
So, we'll begin with one of your pet areas, which has been rarely talked about, urbanization. You worked in the past on urbanization. You at one point in time did active research in this area. And we have been trying to understand that what is the government's approach to urbanization. We see various parts of it, but try to present us a picture of what urbanization or what is the urbanization policy of the government.
So, if you'll indulge me a little bit to go into a bit of background theory.
Yes.
Because what you're witnessing is a fundamental shift in the frame of reference in and frame of philosophy that we have had on urbanization since independence. So, if you go back to the 1950s, what happened is an imposition of a new way of thinking about cities, deriving a lot from the thinking of Le Corbusier. So, what we did was in sort of impose a very top-down model of urbanization. And this is where you got this idea of an ideal city, which was imposed from the top, inspired presumably by Le Corbusier himself. And the idea was to lay out these Cartesian layouts. And in fact, the word is
models,
used very
yes,
often.
Yeah.
You know, a grid. And then you had a standardized building codes, which led to certain kinds of buildings being built and so on. Now, this modernism, you have to remember, was a very major break from how we did cities before independence. And I'm not just talking about the colonial period, but even before that. It's not that we didn't have straight roads and so on. We've been doing that from Harappan times. But the enormous top-down imposition of a certain Cartesian Euclidean order was very, very much about a thinking about cities in this particular top-down way.
How has that changed now?
So, let me first explain to you what happened as a result of this. So, we look at cities before independence, there is a lot of variety. So, if you look at Jaipur is very different from Guwahati, which is very different from Chennai.
Organically built.
Organically built. There is local architecture and much more variety in urban outcomes.
Mixed usage by natural
absolutely
design.
Whereas, after independence, what happens here is that you have this similar kind of what I call is cement block CPWD architecture that becomes the hallmark of post-independence architecture. So, you see the same kind of boxes built in Jodhpur, the same kind of boxes are being built in Indore, the same kind of cement boxes are being built in Jorhat.
Flat houses, residential markets removed from residential.
Absolutely.
No organic mandis.
Yes, and huge amount of zoning being imposed. What is this? This is a top
artificial zoning in that.
Absolutely. This is a top-down imposition of whatever happens to be the town planner's view of how the ideal city should work. And going all the way up to the planning commission also thinking that this is how the JNURM, for example. JNURM is very much about wise people sitting in planning commission deciding what Shillong wants, what Kanpur wants and so on. So, this is very much a top-down Cartesian approach.
Is this the reason why JNURM failed? I mean, you know, we know very well that JNURM actually could not use this funding, you know.
So, there were certain interventions that worked, but I would say on average, the cities continued to be more or less how they were.
The same, okay.
Where there has been a break in the last 5 years and how we think about cities is in the breakdown of this top-down Cartesian approach.
Okay.
And moving away to a different kind. So, there is still conceptions of how to think about cities, but much more contextualized. If you see this, so there are many manifestations of this. So, let me give you some examples. One of them is the smart city approach. Now, in the smart city approach, what happened in 2015-16?
The assumption of the smart city is that it is a digital approach, that it involves cameras, it involves this central control room, and most of the money in the smart city is being spent on, you know, so-called digitizing the city.
So, this
technology
is actually completely wrong idea of what, unfortunately, the word smart in the last 7-8 years has come to be defined by smartphones. But that is not what smart cities are about. Smart cities are about evolving contextualized solutions. Smartness is not about digital.
Absolutely.
Now, sometimes it may be, but by and large, that is not where the smartness comes from. So if you look at the smart cities project, what happened? It's a very, for the first time in 15-16, the central government went and asked for, it was like almost like a contest. What did different municipalities want for their cities? So different cities asked for different things. So Varanasi wanted its ghats cleaned. Indore wanted a cleaner city. It wanted its chappan, that lane food.
Chappan bhog, yeah.
The chappan lane.
Yeah.
The food, not chappan bhog. It's called the chappan lane or whatever it's called. But anyway, it wanted a food thing. Surat wanted the fort area to be cleaned up and upgraded. There were other cities who wanted, Coimbatore wanted its old water system to be renovated. And therefore, lake and parks being built around there, those traditional lakes. And so on. There are many, many outcomes. So
every city kind of demanded what it wanted.
Yes. And so this is one.
It was not one.
Yes.
So different projects came up.
Yes.
So all those different projects got funded through Smart City.
So that was one project. There was another project. So for example, what I'm trying to do is to show you the manifestation of this new approach. So again, trying to help people, poor people get houses, but anybody get houses is an old thing. Earlier, the approach was town planners would decide, okay, you know, DDA, say, in Delhi would decide EWS housing would be built in certain part of the city. Now, again, same problem happened. Top-down approach, built houses, and many of those houses are still empty because there's a very poor take-up, because they are in the wrong place, they are built in the wrong design, not the way we Indians live. So now what happens is something called Prime Minister's Awas Yojana comes.
Where money is given to an individual to build his own houses where he wants in the city.
Yes.
So that's a change in approach.
So rural may be ho raha hai, urban may be ho raha hai.
Correct.
And there are different contexts. Now some places EWS housing is still being built. But on the other hand…
Under PMAY.
Yes. But there are many different outcomes that are allowed. So supposing somebody has access to a piece of land or they can pool a piece of land, housing is being built. It is… At the bottom that they are deciding how, what kind of house, some people are upgrading houses. So some people may be living in an old, dilapidated house, they are upgrading their house, whatever. Point is, you can see repeatedly we are relying for contextualized solutions. Another approach is, different cities wanted big projects, not just the smart city project, but they are big transportation, infrastructure kinds of projects. So those are also different. Central government, of course, is involved, but… You have to remember the state and municipal governments are the main primary movers of this. And here also, look at the kinds of ways we are thinking about it. For example, take Mumbai. We always had a presumption that Mumbai had a particular urban sort of architecture and we could not interfere with it because the great British had built it. They had built those two train lines and those two roads. And we had to somehow stick to it. Maybe we could improve it a little bit at the margin. But there had been no reconceptualization of this at all. But now look at what's going to happen, which is already in the way, and in the next 24 to 36 months, it will be completed. There will be a coastal road.
Yeah.
There will be an underground railway system. There is a new link being built to the mainland with the Trans-Harbour link. There is a new airport being built in Navi Mumbai. And then, of course, there's the Bombay Port Trust land that can also be redeployed into urban spaces. Some of it is happening and a lot of it is happening.
How is it happening? Is it happening from the city or from the state?
No, no.
Depends
where the land is, who owns the land. There are different concessions being given. So, there is no one solution.
Single model.
So, again, I'm coming back to this idea that it's contextualized. You cannot solve Mumbai's metro and finance and design Mumbai's metro system in the same way as you're doing Kashi Vishwanath corridor in Varanasi. And, you know, so Kashi Vishwanath is also a contextual solution to a issue relating to a particular spot. But what you can see here is that it is a repeated willingness to engage with and question and rebuild in an organic way in the context in which we are. And I will give you another example. Right here in Delhi, there is a mental block against rethinking the Central Vista project because oh my God, what will dear old the ghost of Luttians think if we interfered with this? I'm sorry, we are an independent country, we can do whatever we wish.
Absolutely.
Of course, we have to apply our mind to it. I don't want mindless redevelopment. But how can you, take that
as the only truth. Design.
And particularly since many of these buildings had nothing to do with Luttians himself.
Yeah.
For example, Shastri Bhavan being pulled down is surely a good thing. I mean, I cannot think of any good reason why Shastri Bhavan should not be pulled down. I mean, those who visit it don't like it, those who work in there don't like it.
Yeah,
it's simply not a
difficult place to work, actually.
It is not fit for being a 21st century office.
You can't air condition it for
you
instance.
Can't do anything with it. It has to be pulled down and rebuilt. Similarly, rethinking even the use of...
So, let's come back to this. So, there are disparate projects distributed across multiple cities. Each of them are arising from the demand of the city or the municipality. The funding for those are happening differently.
Yes.
So, what is the role of the state or the center in this? Enabling this?
So, obviously, it depends on what it is. Do remember that in our constitution, the local government and the state is primarily responsible for the city.
Now, but they don't have the resources to develop
the city. So, therefore, certain areas the central government will provide support. It may be technical support, for example, building metro systems, it may be financing support. But it has to be ultimately owned by the people of that city. Just like the houses we build under Prime Minister's Awas Yojana have to be owned by the people who live in it.
Absolutely.
So, the point I'm making here is you have to understand the conceptual flip that we have done.
So, that flip is understood, that it has gone from centrally top-down approach to organic bottom-up approach.
Yes.
Now, there is another assumption or myth or reality, whichever bucket you want to put it in, is the capacity. That typically, municipalities don't have the capacity to raise funds, one. Second, they also don't have the capacity to conceptualize projects of the kind that would absorb, say, 1,000 crore, 2,000 crore. And most of the Mumbai projects are, in multiple thousands of crores. So, where does the capacity, how do you build capacity downwards?
So, one of the things is, unless you begin doing things, capacities will never come. It's a chicken and egg problem. So, let's be clear. We were able to build great cities in the Bronze Age. We were able to build great cities in the Medieval Age. We were able to build great cities in colonial times. It was not that colonial occupiers told us to do everything. Ultimately, much of it was done by Indians only. So, we have brought it upon our own heads that we don't have capacity. We don't have capacity because we systematically destroyed that capacity by putting this top-down idea of what a city has to be like. After all, Jaipur was also built by the Indians during medieval period. So, why can't the descendants of those who built old Jaipur be able to build today's modern cities? They can. The problem is we don't seem to have the confidence of it, and it is mostly cobwebs in our head. And I'll give you a very good example of how this cobwebs in our head restrains us. Take for example Raisina Hill. Okay.
Yeah.
Now the buildings on Raisina Hill are clearly beautiful and we have every intention of preserving them. But there is nothing written there that North Block and South Block have to be government offices.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We are now redeploying them as the National Arts Museum and National History Museum. Now, they are clearly great spaces for doing this because they have high ceilings, they have lots of courtyards, and very importantly, they will open up the Raisina Hill to the public, right? So, we will now when we redeploy this, there's a lot of opposition. Oh, how these were built to be offices. Yes, they were built to be offices of the 1920s and 1930s. There is nothing in our mental conception, rules or anything to stop us from redeploying it to the public to do other things with it. After all, we all go to the Louvre. The Louvre was originally a palace, then it became the finance ministry, then it became a museum. When it became a museum and became popular, they built this glass pyramid in the middle of it. So, all great cities are built on evolution. And the same people who complain that, oh my God, you are changing, are the same people who go to Paris and take selfies in front of the pyramid.
I'm not going to spend time on people who complain. Okay, I'm going to spend time on, you know, what is the conceptual change or shift that you have this government has brought about, at least in terms of urbanization. So one is you explained in detail. Now tell me a little bit about moving forward. You know, some of these westernized concept of livable cities or cities with more mixed usage of land, cities with better usage of land, cities with less usage of glass and frontal glass and all those things, they are still a challenge.
So let me say that,
and all those challenges sometimes reside in some code somewhere.
So the one important thing here is that the idea of livability is not a Western concept. Everybody, everywhere in the world wants to have livable cities. In fact, some of the most livable cities in the world, like Singapore, are not in the West, they're in East. But anyway, from the beginning of time, we in India have invested into livability of our cities. So the point is, we need to invest.
Our cities are not livable anymore. I mean, like Delhi is not livable.
Yes.
Gurgaon is not livable. I mean, most of the new cities are not. Bangalore.
So the problem has been that since independence, we have not thought about livability. It's not a Western idea. The problem was, in fact, the imposition of a Cartesian idea of livability, which does not correlate to what happens in our day-to-day lives. I'll give you one example. When you build a new city, where is the Ram Leela grounds? They're an important part of our cultural space.
Yes.
Where does the Durga Puja happen? Where does Holi get?
Where are those spaces?
Where are those spaces? We don't build those spaces. Since independence, the cities that are built, where are the temples?
There are no spaces for temples in new cities.
So the point of the matter is, that's a part of our cultural life. I'm just giving you one side of it. Where, similarly, we all know we are not atomized families. We live in a certain way you can call it the community is an important part of it. So you go and look at historical precincts. You will have the Nukkad in Ahmedabad. You have the Pol.
Yeah.
So what is it? So those are the spaces where the community living happens. We are not atomized, privacy obsessed families. So where does this happen? Now, interestingly, we are recreating this in gated communities, in condominiums and so on.
In a very...
But we are doing it in a certain way.
Yeah.
But it is happening because we are trying to recreate it. But it is happening as an exception, not the rule.
Yeah.
It is almost by violating our building codes that we are going about doing it. Or if we, so...
But the buildings remain the same. The glass frontal...
That's fine. But a lot of it is, by the way, hardwired in our building codes.
Yeah.
Why are they hardwired in our building codes? Because we decided top down in the 50s and 60s that certain kind of modernity is what we should aspire for.
Is it also hardwired in our architects to build it that way?
Well, it got all hardwired that way because we had certain kinds of building codes, then we educated our architects in a particular way and so on and so forth. And therefore, what is now interestingly happening in these gated communities, for example, in Bangalore, they are recreating in some ways by creating common spaces, building. And by the way, it is quite telling that this response has come from the East. So this condominium concept of the Ahmedabad Pol came from Singapore. They are the biggest developers of these gated but large gated communities where you create these smaller villages, so to speak. Now, so it didn't come from the West. It came from the East because we also share with them these kinds of cultural things.
Yeah,
but if you go back to China, you will see these circular family clan villages, which are built as one big house or one big family. So there are many, architectural solutions to our way of living. We are recreating it in various ways now, post-modernism, as we move away from these individual houses on a layout approach. That individual houses on a layout is basically recreation of working class housing in Western cities during their period of industrialization. That is basically what we try to recreate here, thinking it was the epitome of urban design. But we are breaking away from it ourselves and trying to recreate
From a policy point of view, from a state or city perspective, where is the change or shift happening?
So, one of them is simply to free local communities to do different things.
So, free away from the building code itself?
I think in the end what should happen is different cities, different states should have their own different building codes. Why should the building code of Guwahati make sense in Ladakh? It doesn't. Now, ironically, this unifying building code did not happen because of central pressure. It just happened because we had imbibed this top-down approach so thoroughly in our thinking that every state took on
the building code that was given by the center. Because nobody had the capacity to build their own code.
Yeah, well, one of them was that it was not that they didn't, after all, they were building cities before that. It's not about capacity. That's the point I keep coming. It's not a capacity problem. It was an intellectual failure.
At what level?
At every level. Because it was, you have to see, this is parallel also to five-year plans. And the entire idea that wise people sitting in planning commission know who to give permits to do produce steel, who should be given permits to produce cars. So it is the same thinking process.
Interesting. So let's come to another interesting subject that you recently raised, which is the importance of patents and the capacity of patents giving in this country. You wrote a paper on this. You said that it's important for the country to recognize that this is important, and we do not have enough people within the Indian patent system to give patent at the speed that they need to be given. So what is the problem here, and what is exactly the problem in your words, and what is the solution that you have defined?
So you can of course read the details in my paper, but you see, if we want to be in the knowledge economy and we want to compete in the world, in the world of ideas, in the world of innovation, and so on, we clearly need a IPR regime that is up to speed. And that means that, our patent office and our trademark office as well, copyrights as well, but I'm leaving that out for now, has to be able to deliver patents to us. Otherwise, the rest of the world will patent many of or our innovators will have to go abroad to patent to get patent protection. So what has happened is that there has been a greater and greater recognition of this in recent times. Some amount of expansion has happened. So as recently as 2016 or something, seven years ago, we used to only do 10,000 patents a year. That has gone up to now 29,000 patents a year. But before we begin celebrating this, do remember that China is doing 500,000 patents a year. Some of it may be dodgy, I agree.
Most of it would be dodgy.
Enough of it is good. And in any case, that is the world we have to compete in.
Fundamentally, China actually does not believe in patent. I mean, China's manufacturing
system they built it on not having patents, but having reached the other side of the cycle, now they are very great believers in patents. So the point of the matter is,
is the control over the knowledge economy, as you said, and patent per se, again, a Western construct?
Well, there is something to be said that some people say, let it be all free.
Let it not all be free, but let it be controlled not through the patent that has already been given.
We live in a certain patent, global patent universe. Now, we can debate whether that universe needs to be changed. That's a longer and more complex debate. Fact is, there is a certain set of rules that exist international.
So, there is a little change in this.
Need to compete.
Yeah, so that's agreed. And but there's a slight change in the, and there's a slight so-called curve in that road, which is that, interestingly, a few months back, the patent WIP recognized the fact that countries can recognize traditional knowledge and register it. And that knowledge will, like GI was registered for a geographical location, this would be spread over the country, but it would be, where are we on that?
I'll come to that. But let's first be establish that we need, if we want to live in this world with the global intellectual property architecture as it exists in the world, we have to go from where we are to a different level. Otherwise, our own intellectual properties will not be recognized by the rest of the world. Our innovators will not be able to compete in this world, will not be able to benefit from this world. So, given
that is an argument well accepted.
And for that, let us be very clear, our patenting the capacity has to go up by order of magnitude. So, if you read the paper, this is about dramatically increasing the number of...
By 200 times.
Significantly. But to
29,000 to half a million.
Yeah. We can't get to half a million in one shot without the quality breaking down, but at least we should aspire to 75,000 patents a year kind of level. And that requires, firstly, the number of people have to go up, and the processes have to be simplified and much more digitized and so on. So, there are a whole bunch of things. This is, the people can read the paper for the details, but that is one part of it. The second part, which is how do you use this patent for other things other than just new knowledge? One part is traditional knowledge, which is the point you were making. Absolutely. We need to be able to either patent it or provide some sort of an intellectual protection to saying that these kinds of things are common, part of the commons, and whether we allow for that to be patented or a different kind of patent or you allow GI tagging. By the way, the West, when it comes to its own traditional knowledge, are quite adept at protecting it. They will not allow Nasik bubbly wine to be called champagne.
Absolutely.
So, we can play the game too. The problem is we spend most of our time complaining about others and not playing when many of those rules allow us to play the same game.
So how do we play this traditional knowledge game?
So, well, as I said, the West has thankfully created lots of good examples of what we can do. GI tagging is just one of them. We can create communal tagging, or at least when some other country in the world goes and patents this thing, we should have a system of challenging it. All of these things can be done.
Is there a state capacity, an organization, institution where it should be housed?
Well, clearly we have a patent office. It is more than capable of dealing with it if we expand it. You see, just like in the case
of... Should it be expanded to traditional knowledge?
We can. We'll see how this evolves, but do not assume that we are not capable of playing this game. So, what I'm trying to tell you is, we start always with this idea that where's the capacity? Where's the capacity to build our cities? Where's the capacity of traditional knowledge? Hello, we had the capacity to come up with the knowledge in the first place. So, we always try and kick ourselves ki hum log kar nahi sakte. For some reason, we cannot go and win gold medals in badminton, but it turns out we can. But if you start with this thinking process that we cannot win, then we cannot win. We start with the process that, with the idea that the rest of the world will define it. Well, sometimes it will, but we can also play by those rules. Sometimes we can even define those rules.
So, how do we get into the either defining this rule or...
Well, first of all, we need to be able to play this game. Even with the rules that exist, we can play this better. So, let us get into this game. So, first of all... Let's take the world of cricket, which we dominate in some ways, not just on the field, but in other ways. How did we had to win the 1983 World Cup to start with, and that created the muscle.
So, in traditional knowledge, our equivalent of World Cup win
would be that at least the non-traditional guys become
a big player. A patent on yoga.
Well, we have to be very careful. So, there are certain things where we have to be very careful. You see, there is some advantages to providing certain kinds of knowledge for free as loss leaders, so to speak, then we can spend, because the yoga comes with much deeper thing. The simplified Hatha yoga, which is what is called now yoga, is a good loss leader perhaps. Okay. I mean, so we have to be a little careful about not trying to patent and control everything. So, think that through as well. And, there are some things if you want to be a global leader, you need to be provide. So, for example, the English language is a huge benefit to the Anglo-Saxon world. So if they try to patent the English language
is,
I'm just giving an example. If the Anglo-Saxon world tried to patent and directly extract rent from the use of the English language, it would be a foolish thing to do because they would actually lose from that. So the same way, we should be willing to freely provide yoga as a way to access the much deeper philosophies and intricacies and things that relate to our Indian culture. And once people are interested in yoga, they may be interested in Indian music, they may be interested in Indian food, they may be interested in Ayurveda, they may be interested in coming to India. So the spin-offs of that may be much higher than trying to patent yoga.
So that's a very interesting issue. I mean, we'll discuss it much in detail. But protecting our own cultural assets is an area that's very rarely researched and very rarely protected, at least in India.
So, yes, absolutely.
And never monetized as an economic asset, you know.
So, this is absolutely correct, what you have pointed out. Our cultural assets need to be monetized. Even if it's given away free, there are other ways to monetize
it. Yes, yes.
So, my view on this is, we first of all need to be aware that there are such as things as cultural assets. One of the major problems is that we spend so much of our time in fact, there is a whole cultural attitude that somehow our assets should be negated in some ways.
Yeah. So but that's a different world. I mean, like that.
This negativity is very deeply ingrained in our intellectual and elite class.
It is because of
colonial legacies.
Yes, absolutely. That thinking itself is.
Yes,
wrong,
because you have to remember that a very significant proportion of our intellectual and power elites are descendants of British collaborators. So this is a very ingrained problem that pops up every time even a movie comes up, say, on the Cholas.
Yeah.
Then a huge amount of effort goes around, no, the Cholas are not really Hindus, or they are not a part of our civilization, or they have nothing to do with the Brihadeshwara temple. You've got to be kidding me. But this happens.
But I like the fact that you said that, you know, our intellectual elites are actually descendant of British collaborators.
But that's a fact.
You can actually... It's well documented.
It's a documented fact that leading intellectuals of post-independence India, the historians, the writers, the journalists, and many other, and even members of the bureaucracy were active collaborators with the British. And I'm not talking loose collaboration or who happened to be a school teacher or something.
No. They were actually active, benefited both in terms of title, land, and in jobs, you know.
So, and actively did things which perpetuated British rule. So, it's not surprising that the stories they tell themselves and consequently want us to
believe in
are the stories that are consequently attempt to negate our cultural and historical legacy.
And thank you very much for that, Sajid. Urbanization and the cultural aspect of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.